Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
When we think of Matthew Harding and Chelsea Football Club, there is so much that has gone unwritten and never been discussed publicly. We know the story about Harding and Ken Bates, the details of their disagreements, the conflict and fallout right up to Harding's tragic passing in October 1996. There are no secrets there. Or are there? What were Harding's ambitions for Chelsea? Was he just a wealthy fan spending his personal fortune on the club as nothing more than an expensive hobby? Was there a plan? What motivated and inspired him? In this second installment of the Matthew Harding tapes, the blueprint is revealing key details Chelsea supporters and the wider football public have never heard. Until now. I'm Kerry Levy, and alongside Gary Hayes, we're telling the story of modern Chelsea through the voices of those people who have mattered most. In the past 8 years, we've spent piecing the story together. We have spoken to over 180 people on and off the record. Our full 8-part narrative podcast will be dropping on the 31st of May, taking listeners inside Stamford Bridge to tell the club story from the advent of the Premier League to when the Blues lifted the Champions League in 2012. But now we hear from Mark Killick, a close friend of Matthew Harding's, a confidant and an executor of his will. Mark's role in Harding's life was a significant one, and as we're about to hear, it was just as much so in death. Mark's never spoken on the record before, and in this episode reveals new details about Harding's hopes and dreams to make Chelsea not only the preeminent football club in London, but the one team known globally as the London club. Harding's ambition was to take Chelsea forward to new heights, and that would have required new investment. As we speak with Mark, we understand where that may have come from, and how Chelsea's story could have been very different to the one we now know.
I first met Matthew in 1985. I had a business down in Hassocks in West Sussex, and he happened to be a customer that just used to sort of frequent my premises. And the conversation did steer itself to Chelsea, you know, as he used to come in and out the shop. It was obvious that he had a passion for Chelsea and was going at that time with his children. At one point he said to me, "You must come with me, Mark." And at that point I thought, well, actually, I've got my own mates, I don't need to go with you. But Matthew being Matthew would badger and badger me until eventually I said, okay, I'll come with you. And it's almost at that point I started to see him more and more. Besides going to the odd game together, we used to sort of travel back to Hassocks and end up in one of the pubs until about sort of 10:30 at night.
So you say he was badgering you in that enthusiastic way that we get a grip on it as we've learned more about him, that we know he was this enthusiastic character. So, yeah, what was he like as a person? What was he like to get to know?
Right. To begin with, he appears as to be a little bit of a nuisance in a way. He would just come in and he'd bowl into the premises shop I had down there. He'd immediately walk out the back, you know, sort of like there would be no rules for Matthew as far as sort of staying within the confines of the shop. it wasn't long before he was sort of like making me get him a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. But the one thing I would say is that it was a long time till I knew anything about what he did as far as his business was concerned. And we did actually keep that quite separate in a way. So it was just really a friendship that was built up on him coming into my premises and us eventually going to Chelsea together. And this might surprise you, it was a long time till I realised he actually had any money. The first point that I actually had any inkling that he had, might have a large amount of money was when he said to me, Marky Mark, shall I buy Chelsea? And I thought, you must be mad, you know. But it was at that point that I, you know, realised more and more that there was a seriousness to what he actually said. Then actually everything gathered quite a pace after that, when you think about it. I mean, I'm trying to work out how stands were built in that short period of time before we lost Matthew. You know, it seemed to rocket from there.
So when Matthew makes that quip, and judging by his character, I guess he was jesting, but I guess there's that saying, there's many a true word said in jest, right? He probably had that consideration of, I might be able to do this. What are you thinking? Like, suddenly, wow, my friend could buy Chelsea, could own Chelsea. What's going through your mind?
It really did come as a surprise. I actually thought, because Matthew was fun and Matthew would joke, I didn't understand the first instance that there was a real seriousness to the comment. And then post that, things really started to snowball very, very quickly. I was kept in the loop. That's the thing that I would say, that from that time onwards, I was very much in conversation with him about what maybe his plans might be, what he had heard. I had a good road into the rumor mill at that point, you know. It was a good time. It was a good time.
It was a whirlwind 3 years, wasn't it?
Very much so. Very much a whirlwind 3 years. It started to become quite fun going to football with Matthew. I must admit, I think I pushed him into an away trip that he hadn't really been on up to that point. And that was Sheffield Wednesday in the League Cup, I think, at the time, if you remember that one. We got the train up to Sheffield for the evening game. I think it was the first leg, wasn't it? We actually stayed overnight and we all got the train back the next day. But from then on, I think Matthew got the bug for going home and away. And eventually we were flying to games via Jackie Stewart's private jet. It was a reasonably large aircraft. And the nice thing about it was it had one sofa in it and four armchairs, where normally it would probably have about 16 seats. So it was a very comfortable way in which to travel to a game. I think one of the most memorable games, and I remember we were flying back from Everton. I think it was a draw up there. Flying back from Everton, I remember sort of singing all the way as we landed into Gatwick Airport on the runway. I don't think anyone had a seatbelt on, put it that way, which, you know, probably is a little irresponsible, but we probably didn't even notice we were sort of as close to Gatwick as we were. So.
you mentioned getting the plane with Jackie Stewart, or Jackie Stewart's plane.
Yeah.
Sounds glamorous, but how else did it change in terms of Matthew making that initial decision to get more involved with Chelsea in a more official capacity, or more formal capacity, going from fan into, well, share ownership at least? How did that change the dynamic of him supporting Chelsea and you?
It did change the dynamic, because obviously there was a lot more interest around Matthew. You know, we couldn't really go incognito to any games anymore. Well, I could, no problem with me. But there was usually interest in where Matthew was going to be prior to the game. People obviously wanted to meet him. There was often some press people around Matthew as well. But at that time, I think Matthew also had an eye on the future and how he could actually make a difference to Chelsea, because we used to start seeing other guests of Matthew come to football at that point. So people like, say, Keith Harris, who was at the time at the HSBC Bank, I think, prior to going to become chairman of the Football League. You know, so there used to be sort of a guest. I think we have Robert Dallaglio at one game, and Piers Morgan used to rock up to the Arsenal game. So it became a little bit more celebrity, I suppose. And I think, as my friend Paul said, sometimes we used to try and maybe do our own thing on match days and leave Matthew to it a little bit, because there was always the point where we'd actually travel up together. We'd always do that. But there would come a point during the day where I would leave him to go and carry on his duties. As to what they were at the time would obviously did change when he became a director and took his seat in the director's box, and prior to not being in there anymore as well. So things did change. I still maintained my own friends as well prior to Matthew, although they become friends with Matthew as well at that time. So it was quite interesting having that inside knowledge of the club as well, you know, knowing what might, may or may not happen.
What were you privy to as the inside knowledge, as someone who was friends with him? Was he, would he brief you on stuff because he trusted your counsel, right?
Yes. He would, to a point, you know, sort of not on the financials as such, but maybe some of the steps that might be taken via the management, i.e. Glenn at the time, to purchase or look at certain players. So I know we'll probably come on to one in a minute that we'll talk about. But, you know, there was obviously the talk about Ruud before he came. There was chat about Paul Gascoigne at one point. It was a case of really trying to change the way in which Chelsea were able to compete, you know, and actually make a difference. But yeah, so I was privy to that. I was privy to some of the talk as far as the new players that were going to come in. I was interested in some of the backroom stuff as well, you know, interested that Glenn was bringing in some new ideas to the club. You know, I know Glenn brought in some nutrition ideas, brought in yoga as well, I know, which I always thought was a great idea for any footballer to help them stretch out after a game. But yeah, it was an interesting time.
Bringing Matthew into Chelsea, you were privy to his plans or what he thought, when we spoke before, you and Paul both said about, you know, he was a visionary in business and certainly what he did with Benfield. So what else did Matthew see as the future of football and what he wanted to do with Chelsea?
Yes, he was a visionary. He did pride himself on his knowledge of football, and he could have a conversation about football with the best of people. The one vision I think he had for Chelsea was just to very much sort of break that monopoly that really, I suppose, around that time was shared by sort of Arsenal and Man United. And I think he wanted to become the London club, which I think has been achieved in many ways. I think that was probably his dream for Chelsea.
What else outside of those players he was looking at, what else did he see as being the future of football?
I think it was more, as far as football, I'm not sure he had that vision that he shared with me as sort of football in general, that he wanted any change to happen. I think he just wanted Chelsea to have the investment that it needed to break that monopoly at the top of our Premier Division at the time. And equally, you know, break that monopoly that the European clubs had on the European competition. I think that's what excited him about Ruud Gullit. When Ruud Gullit came, Ruud said to Matthew, "I want the cup with the big ears." And that was Ruud's vision, and you know, which we did get, you know. So, and I'm sure Matthew was delighted when we actually won it.
When we spoke before, you explained how he would travel around and there was always the New York Giants or the Boston Red Sox or Manchester United, but there was no one London team, was there?
I think that could well have been a bone of contention, and I'm not sure that even I would have been over comfortable, but I think there was some kind of vision with Matthew to try and make Chelsea synonymous with London itself. You know, sort of it would be London's team. So where we see other major cities, such as sort of Manchester, you know, having two teams with the name Manchester in it. Newcastle as a city, having Newcastle as a team, Leeds having Leeds as their team. You know, there's no London side per se. Whether that would have come to any sort of fruition in a way where the name could have been shared in some, I don't know. But I know that it was definitely putting Chelsea forward as London's premier team, which could have had some commercial legs, you know, abroad as well.
Going back to the concept of Chelsea as the London club, short of coming up with a name like London Chelsea, how do you think he thought about how to present Chelsea as the London club without something like a name change? Because London Chelsea works in a very simple way. It puts the two together and it's saying everyone else doesn't mean anything. How do you think he would have got this across?
I think that would have been difficult. It would have been a case of success leading the whole thing. And then possibly, you know, where the game's gone now is pushing that status first and foremost into Europe and then possibly further afield. I think that probably isn't a subject we spoke about a lot. I knew it was in his mind. And I actually still feel that it would have been difficult for him, as I think it would have been difficult for any of us, to actually push that name change anyway. There had to be another way of doing it without the name change. I think the fans would have all wanted that. They wouldn't have wanted a sort of like name change, I'm sure, you know, so there had to be another way. But then he was the visionary who probably would have found the other way. You know, it's just that none of us have thought about it. I'm sure we would have been synonymous with being the capital city's club and still keep the name that we've loved forever. I think we still do it best now where we sing we're the only team in London won the European Cup. So I think maybe that might have been it. There you go.
So with his vision of breaking up that oligarchy, for want of a better term, of the European clubs as well, he understood that you needed significant funds with which to do that. And he was very clearly a wealthy man, but he wasn't in the billionaire bracket. Did he have ever explained to you a vision of who he'd like to bring in to work with him if he did get control of the club?
I think he would have attracted investment. I think there's no doubt about that. At one time, he was working on sort of sponsorship investment from Virgin, which were a very large company at the time, still are. And also, as I said, he had his contacts within the banking world, especially as sort of banking and insurance in general, are closely linked. So there was always potential there to bring investment into the club. All I know is Matthew was the visionary. He was clever in what he wanted to do, and he certainly was able to charm people into sort of sharing the same vision. There's a story, and it's quite an interesting story, that opened an account with Coutts Bank, you know, so, and as you may or may not know, you know, to open an account with Coutts, you have to have a reasonable income or a reasonable amount of money. And they invited him to lunch. And Coutts had this tradition of never having any drink with their lunch. And Matthew went to lunch and sort of said, well, I'm sorry, I'm not having lunch with you if that's your tradition. And in that one fell swoop, that tradition was finally ended, as someone was sent out to buy some wine so they could enjoy it at lunch. So, you know, so, yeah, there was a certain charm with Matthew that I think would have attracted investment for when it was required.
You mentioned Virgin, and obviously Richard Branson is the person connected with that. What was Matthew's relationship like with him, and how did he come to meet him? Because he did do work with him through Benfield for the balloon trip that they were insuring.
Yes, I think it was at a time where obviously Richard was very well established as a businessman. People were starting to become aware of Matthew, you know, and a lot of that was via his involvement in Chelsea. And Richard was going to fly a balloon around the world and was looking for a sponsor to sponsor the event. And also he wanted someone that would be the spokesman of the event as well. So Richard and Matthew hooked up, and Matthew agreed to be the person in the studio that would actually give updates on where Richard was in the world when he was going on his balloon trip. I think there was a lot more than that going on, because because there was a discussion about some advertising at Stamford Bridge as well. So Matthew and Richard would meet up and sort of just cultivate their relationship going forward. And it was relatively early days, but I know they always enjoyed sort of one another's company, as you can probably imagine.
Because Richard does fit the profile of the sort of character and person Chelsea would have required at that time.
Yes, I think there could have been involvement. I think that Matthew wanted to still be primarily involved, you know, sort of. I think he enjoyed the role that he had, you know, and he had that role with Ken, you know. That's what it was at the time. You know, we had Ken as chairman. Matthew obviously became vice chairman eventually. So there was no position for someone else within the club at that sort of board level as such. But maybe going forward, you know, who knows where the investment might have come in.
And with the commercial relationship that was potentially on the table between Virgin and Chelsea, do you know what that would have looked like? With that, the stadium naming rights, was it just branding around the stadium?
Yeah, I think at the time it was an idea whereby we had the West Stand, if you remember, still in place, the old West Stand. That was in place and it had a huge roof. Matthew's idea was that the roof could be used for advertising because it was on the flight path to Heathrow. So he thought it was a valuable advertising site. I know that Virgin were interested in it as an advertising site. I think eventually, you know, sort of like, because obviously the idea was then discussed at Chelsea, other parties were then brought in. And I think British Airways were the ones that eventually took out that advertising space on top of the West Stand. So, but I think it was just the start. I really do.
Subsequently, following Matthew's passing, you managed the estate. You were the executor of the will. As part of that, you offered Matthew's shares to Richard Branson.
Yes, I mean, the whole idea of an estate, you know, once Matthew's passed, is to actually sort of realise the asset, and so the beneficiaries can then, you know, realise the sort of Matthew's assets as part of his will. So we were under an obligation, you know, to sell the shares, not in a hurry by any means, because the other obligation is we have to get best price for them. The other thing at that time, we are, as an estate, aren't going to be making any more major investment in Chelsea, you know, because we don't have the income means in order to be able to do that. So we were looking at the time to see whether we could place the shares with people. It's quite interesting when you get to that sort of stage, you know, there are only certain people that would be able to sort of afford those shares. So Richard was someone that we did speak to. He was interested to a point. And I think the sticking point at the time was the share price. I think the share price actually that we wanted then was probably what we got right at the end of it with Abramovich. But I think if you remember, or you may not remember, the share price was quite buoyant then. It was sort of up, it was down, and we had an obligation to get the best price that we possibly could. So with Richard, we couldn't come to any agreement on that. So that just fizzled out.
Because I think you said it was 50p a share. Was that the value you were going on?
I think it was something like that. But it's one of those ones that don't quote me now, because it's, you know, so many years ago that, it gets a bit fuzzy, I must admit.
Because the share price sold to Mr. Abramovich was 35p a share.
Yeah. So it could, that's right. So I think, you know, possibly that's where Richard even saw the value, and we saw it higher at the time. So we couldn't meet in the middle, you know. So
outside of his personal wealth and obviously the wealth of Virgin, was there any reason outside of that you, and obviously his connection with Matthew, was there any reason why you approached him? Was it that he had an interest in Chelsea before that you knew of?
Probably with Richard. He had an interest in what Matthew was doing. I would think with Richard, you know, it's all about pushing his own brand. So if there was a way in which that he could push his brand for Virgin, which then puts him in a different category to Matthew. It would have been a very different reason for coming on board with some kind of ownership. You know, as I said right at the beginning, Matthew came on board because of his love for Chelsea, and no real reason apart from that.
I don't mean to go on to this too much. It's just that it is a really interesting concept given what's happened with Chelsea and Roman Abramovich 7 or 8 years later. So would you mind just bringing us into how those conversations evolved up to the point that they ended with Richard Branson, just to give that insight to how these things happen?
Yes, okay, yeah. So it would be a case that we would make an informal inquiry of him as to whether he would be interested in purchasing the shares, because they were for sale. There was no secret about the fact that they were for sale, and it would have needed an investor with some money to be able to purchase them as a whole, because they were valuable as a whole. You know, we couldn't start splitting them up into little bits and pieces because they would lose their value. So I think once that happened, we had a meeting with Richard, and that took place at his house, and we discussed the idea of it, no more than that. So after that initial meeting, I think it was left very much with Richard himself, with his advisors, and also with my advisors as well. You know, so that was left for more due diligence. And then I had a final phone call with Richard where we did just speak about an informal price. And I remember him saying, no, I think that's a little bit too much for me. And that was the end of conversations.
This is a question based on your opinion of someone that was close to Chelsea and seeing everything. How do you think that would have worked with Ken Bates had Richard Branson stepped in with ownership of those shares? Because that would have changed the whole landscape of Chelsea, right?
Yes, I think so. I think possibly, you know, this is something where it's been documented, but and that's all I can say. I think because there wasn't total clarity on the share ownership at the time, Ken, and I know he'd say this still, he spoke for the shares, but I think when anyone tried to do any sort of have any formality about ownership, that became a little bit more sort of unclear for anyone wanting to invest. And I think that could have been a problem. I'm not saying it would have been, it might have been a problem. It could have held up any kind of partnership going forward. I think that possibly one of the reasons why Chelsea were AIM listed rather than full stock market listed. It's difficult to use the word, really. You know, sort of, as I say, there was no person behind some of the shares. That's what it appeared, you know, sort of without having full knowledge.
Because I guess for someone like Richard Branson, you said that Chelsea would have been a great, for want of a better term, a great tool to support his brand and the way he... You know, he's always been a disruptor with Virgin. You know, you look at the way he's always marketed, the way he's been creative. I guess the next step, if he had taken those shares, because do you remember how much of a percentage of Chelsea those shares were worth?
I think they were around about sort of 23%. I think it was something like that. It was below any sort of real voting right. You know, sort of like there's sort of some key figures you get to where you would then have to maybe buy the rest of the shares. So it was below that.
And do you recall the overall value of what that would have been if you're able to divulge that?
I'm not sure. No, I'd have to work that out, and I'm not sure.
Because I'm just thinking, you know, for Richard Branson to own 23% of Chelsea, the next step would have been that you need to take the whole thing, given, like you say, about the situation around some shares where Chelsea were listed.
Yeah.
What it would have meant for his investment.
Yes, yeah. And I think the other thing, and you probably got to appreciate this as well, I don't think Richard would have wanted to have been that sort of figurehead chairman like Ken was and like Matthew possibly could have been. I don't know. He'd never said that he wanted to, you know, be that figurehead chairman to me. I think because Richard has so many other interests elsewhere and is not a football man, you know, let's face it as well. You know, you've never heard him speak about football. You never heard him talk about a favourite team. So, yeah, whether he would have wanted that full-scale ownership, I can't speak for him either. So
I guess he would have needed the dynamic. I'm just thinking of Chelsea now that you've got Clear Lake Capital and Todd Bowley, and maybe Virgin was the Clear Lake and then they need the figurehead in the way that Todd Bowley is.
Possibly. Yeah. This is...
He gave a video where he spoke at Matthew's memorial service.
Yes, he did, yeah. And I think you can draw from what he said on that piece that, that was a developing relationship. I think they were fond of one another, and I could have only seen it becoming a relationship that was rich going forward.
And moving on to Ken Bates, we're speaking about stuff about, regarding Matthew that isn't just Ken Bates, but we can't talk about Matthew without avoiding the Ken Bates relationship. So this was a defining part of his involvement with Chelsea, wasn't it? How did you see from the beginning to the end with Ken Bates? And we've spoken to David Cooper, and he gives his perspective on that. He says that he doesn't recall Matthew ever being particularly upset with Ken, but there was obviously conflict at a boardroom level. How did you see that relationship and the dynamic of it?
I think it would have been one of those things that would have resolved in a way. I really do. I don't think it necessarily was either going to come down one way or the other, whereby, it's often been sort of described as the battle for Stamford Bridge. I don't necessarily feel that it would have had a sort of a winner and a loser at the end of it. And I think that I've got the feeling that they would have resolved any differences and possibly push the club forward to maybe a natural succession at some point in the future, as maybe a change of chairmanship. But that seemed to be the feeling that I always got. I know that they both had different ideas for the best way forward. When Matthew first said to me, "What do you think of Ken?" I said, "I think Ken's done a great job," because I think we all felt that as Chelsea fans that went through that time where I've still got my Save the Bridge certificate, where I, sort of walked around the pitch on a Sunday. It's because we were all very worried that we would lose the club that we actually loved and adored, and it was actually our lives. That was the big thing. So I was like Ken. The difference was that Ken always had to run it as the business that he'd always run. So therefore, the Chelsea Village development was very important to Ken. Making the whole ground more commercial. And I remember Ken sort of saying that he wanted a ground that wasn't just used once every 2 weeks, that it was used every day of the week. And that sounds sensible. I think what actually went against that in some respects was because, although it's in a fantastic part of London, that commercial interest was going to compete against all the other wonderful sort of restaurants and hotels, etc., that were available in that particular area. So that's where Ken was going with his vision. Matthew was very much more of the vision of the football club. I'm not saying that Ken didn't have that vision too, but Matthew wanted to sort of do everything that would be an advantage to Chelsea going forward, i.e., the size of the pitch. I know that was contentious, and Matthew did come down on the side of Glenn. I remember Glenn sort of saying that, we won't be able to break down these European sides unless we got enough width in which to do it. So Matthew was very much on that side of things, which, I would imagine Ken would be upset of having to change some plans that were very much in place, so there would have been disagreements, I'm sure. I can't really remember what the actual defining moment was whereby Matthew was eventually thrown out of the director's box, so I think it's a case of it just happened. But whether they would have kissed and made up further down the line, I don't see that wasn't on the agenda.
You say Matthew asked you what you thought of Ken.
Yeah.
Did he ever give his opinion on what he thought of Ken?
I actually think he liked him. I really do. I think he actually enjoyed it, enjoyed his company. They had fun when they were out. They were rude to one another. So I don't think I ever heard Matthew saying, "I don't like him," not in those words. I really didn't. So I think he respected him. And I think Matthew as well probably felt the same way we did as fans, that for a time he was a guardian of the club, you know.
Do you think actually that in a way, in Bates, he'd found a perfect adversary who was worthy of his talents almost, that he understood this was a challenge to work with Bates?
I think so, very much. Yeah, he did like Bates. I know he liked Bates. I think he saw Bates as a bit of a chess game as well, you know, wondering what Ken would do next and what his next move should be based on that as well. There was no doubt that they were sort of trying to find out more about one another behind the scenes, talking to people, etc., etc., so that they could... yeah, get the measure of one another. Matthew wanted to try and get the measure of Ken, and so therefore by wanting to try meant that he did have a respect for Ken.
We spoke to Colin Hutchinson and we spoke to Glenn about it, and Colin's perspective was, and Ken has said the same, but Ken's, and again, we're not trying to get a retort for Ken Bates here at all, we're just sort of laying it out to get your opinion on this. But Ken said that Matthew held up Chelsea by 5 years. And when we spoke to Colin Hutchinson, he said that the feud between them, again, for want of a better term, but that conflict between them held Chelsea up 5 years. What's your perspective on that? Because Chelsea eventually got to where they wanted to be. But do you think that that sort of got in the way of what Chelsea were trying to be?
I think if we call it a feud, I think if we're then looking at... investment coming into the club to take the club forward is probably not an attractive position to invest in, where you've got two of the major shareholders that appear to be in some kind of conflict with one another. So maybe that's where the 5 years comes in. You know, I mean, personally, I wouldn't agree with that. I think that Matthew's investment probably took the club on 5 years more than anything else, you know. So, you know, but it's opinions. And to be fair as well, you know, I wasn't in there at the workings of the club, you know, but I do know that Matthew made his investment, and I know it's been said, you know, he was paid interest and what have you, but I think he was giving loans to the club where there were no other loans coming into the club. And eventually those loans were converted, obviously, into share equity, you know. So you know, his investment stayed within that club, you know. I think there has to be, with any money coming in, sort of obviously formal arrangements, and those would have been between Matthew and the club. You know, I wouldn't have had any privy to that. But they were still given with a good heart by Matthew, as I say, and there was money that he probably could have invested elsewhere in his own business and made a lot more money at the time.
Did he ever imagine a future where clubs would be valued in the high billions, not just a billion, that is, you know, Chelsea was sold for $4.5 billion?
Yeah, I don't think he did at the time, Matthew, be honest, you know, because I think even he was questioning the valuation of Chelsea when it went to the AIM market, you know, have we got the right value on this club? There was no precedent set at the time that we had any idea that clubs were going to go for the amounts of money that, say, Bowley paid for Chelsea. I mean, if we'd known that, we might have got that pound together back in 82. I think I would have done.
Let's talk about the exciting stuff with Matthew's plans for Chelsea from a football perspective. You dangled the carrot of Paul Gascoigne earlier. There was Matt Letizier. So what was he talking to you about? What was your view of what he wanted to do with the team?
Matthew loved skillful footballers. You know, one of Mother Matthew's favourite players at Chelsea was Alan Hudson. And Matthew appreciated a footballer with skill, and he wanted that type of player playing at Chelsea. We were all about results, and let's face it, we as fans, you know, and I know I'm an older fan, it was all about results, really, you know, for a long, long time. But I think Matthew wanted to bring in a player that would mean that we actually got the result, but we've got the result playing some very silky football, as Matthew would say, silky football. So that's what he was trying to bring to the club. And I think he saw Glenn as someone that would bring that type of football. And mainly, I think Glenn's reputation enabled us to actually go after some players that we would never have dreamt of really prior to that at Chelsea. And I think Matthew had bought into that vision going forward. Who else did he admire? He was an admirer of Matt Letizia. Yeah, he was a great admirer of Redknapp as well, you know. There were quite a few footballers that he would love to have seen in a Chelsea shirt, you know. But we had some great ones there, you know. We had, you know, Mark Hughes. We had, you know, great players coming in.
Is that Jamie Redknapp?
Yeah,
a young Jamie Redknapp before he went to Liverpool.
Yeah.
So he knew his football then, because Jamie wasn't a star by any stretch. He was just an up and coming talent. But obviously, it's different to today, where with social media and club websites, you can know everything about youth teams. But Jamie wasn't the player that, in terms of his profile, it had become.
Yeah, no. Matthew would study things. You know, he wouldn't just turn up at Chelsea. He'd watch a lot of football on television as well when he could, when he wasn't working. And he appreciated the game. I would suggest he appreciated the game in its terms of skill more than I did. You know, let's face it. You know, I was there in the late 70s, early 80s, also. So, yeah, no, Matthew appreciated his football.
So his relationship with Glenn was based on that shared love of football, because the man you're describing appreciates what Glenn Hoddle was trying to bring and what Glenn Hoddle was as a player.
Yeah, very much, very much. You know, sort of, and it was definitely the start, but it was the start of something else. It's another chapter, wasn't it? Because what I don't want this to appear, because what I like about your podcast is it's about the way in which we've gone from what we had to complete glory. And there's no one thing that actually did that. It was a case of finding that tipping point with all these characters in, all these skillful characters, skillful players that actually got us to where we needed to get to. The club always had heart. I think we can all agree on that. And it was a case of directing that heart into the pitch, actually. So there was always heart elsewhere around the ground, and it was a case of directing it where it needed to go.
So just moving on to 22nd of October 1996.
Yeah.
You didn't go to the game, but what are your memories of it? If you just want to recall that without me asking too many questions, I guess if you could just start from the beginning and recall how those events unfolded for you personally.
Yeah, okay then. So, I mean, I suppose the big thing was that Matthew went by helicopter rather than aeroplane this time. One of the things about using sort of Jackie Stewart's jet was we had to land at sort of an airfield, which would always give us a little bit more logistics as far as either getting to the airfield, which was often either Biggin Hill, or we did go from Gatwick. And then when we landed, the other end was getting from the airport in the city to the ground. So I think based on a conversation that he'd had with Tony Blair, he realized that there was a helicopter that he could charter for trips going forward. And he actually chartered a string of 7 away games, of which Bolton was the first one. Some will remember that prior to the Bolton game, we had a home game against Wimbledon. And at the time, Matthew used to meet us upstairs in Ozzy's bar in the East Stand. And after the game, we used to have a drink before we made our way back down to Sussex. And it was at that game that he actually said to me, because he always called me Marky Mark. And he said, Marky Mark, Bolton away in the cup. He said, are you coming? We're going by a helicopter. I actually sort of hesitated a little bit and said, I don't know whether I can, Matt. I'll let you know. And Ray stood next to me. He said, Ray, you come in. Ray said, yeah, I'll come. So Ray went on that particular trip, and I didn't go to the game at all. So I just watched it at home. I think it was, I remember watching it on TV. I'm sure I did, you know, sort of, and whether it was just highlights, I might have watched. Went to bed with, you know, no thoughts. I'd know Matthew had got up there. I spoke to him that morning because he'd got back from a business trip the day before. He'd had a reinsurance meeting out in Germany, and spoke to him on the day. And as usual, I used to speak to him most mornings. I said, no, I'll give you a call tomorrow after the game. We'll have a chat about the game. First thing I remember personally is sort of waking up on the morning after the game and putting on sort of radio and hearing reports of a helicopter that had come down and reports were that were directors from one of the football clubs on the flight. So I knew straight away, you know, I knew straight away. And I also had the thought that when a helicopter comes down, you know, usually they come down. And so I phoned a few people. It became quite apparent that it was Matthew's flight. And it was almost a little bit of a moment for me because Matthew only made his will in the May beforehand. And I remember receiving a phone call from him and saying, oh, I've got to make my will, Mark. I wanted to do this over a drink, but I'm under pressure to get it done. He said, would you be my executor? And actually, I mean, like any sort of request like that, you think you're going to do it when you're well into your 80s, you know, rather than sort of, you know, doing it sort of 5-6 months later, which is what happened. So I knew at that moment that my life changed quite considerably, and another duty befell me at that point. So all of a sudden my life was upside down from that word go, and it was a whole host of meetings that happened. And one of the first things that we had to do as executors was probably make the funeral arrangements. So it was, yeah, very sad time, extremely sad time.
What were those immediate days like for you on an emotional level, but also, like you say, you've got practical things that you've got to consider: funerals, wills, the family?
It was completely full on, really. There were a lot of family issues that we had to deal with. You know, I don't think that's you know, something that people don't know. There was a lot of going to different people. Yeah, the first thing we had to do was sort out the funeral, which we did quite reasonably quickly. I think, you know, so that happened in the 22nd of October. The funeral was sort of like the first week of November. And in the meantime with that, we also had the home game against Tottenham. And there was quite a lot of involvement for me in that as well, because obviously a lot of family members wanted to attend. And I seemed to be the pivot point to try and get things organised with that as well, so that everyone who wanted to be there could be there that day.
What did you make of the outpouring of, I guess, emotion and grief from Chelsea fans? You'd go to Stamford Bridge and that display, the shirts, the flowers.
Yeah, it was extremely emotional. It was extremely, yeah, I felt the whole club came together quite as a family, you know, where we lost someone very dear to all of us. And that was very apparent. I don't think things like that had really been seen at Chelsea in a way. Because of the tragic circumstances, I think it was even worse. I think one of the most poignant moments was the fact that, you know, our first game after that was against Spurs, and the minute silence was you could hear a pin drop in the ground, you know, which normally between our two sets of fans, there wouldn't be that sort of respect being paid.
And then when you see the players, normally for a minute silence, everyone's together around a centre circle, but the players did it in front of the stand.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was lovely. It was, it was, everyone had their own ideas. Everyone made their own script. So the players weren't asked to do that. You know, that's what they did. There was a lot of fondness from the players to Matthew. I mean, Matthew spent a long time down at the training ground having fun with the players, for want of a better word. A lot of them knew him very, very well. And I think they were all very upset. You know, some came to the funeral. Obviously, Glenn was there. Rud was there.
You mentioned a helicopter that Tony Blair had used, and Matthew was using it on Tony's recommendation. What was their relationship like as you saw it?
Matthew was a supporter of New Labour. He didn't hide the fact that he was. And I think that was quite a bit of fun between him and Ken as well. You know, Ken being a staunch Tory and Matthew being New Labour. I think they had a few digs at one another about that, but in a nice way. At the time, Labour realised that they were the poor cousins to the Tories when it came to any type of investment from outside. So Matthew decided to pledge a donation of £1 million to help with New Labour's advertising campaign. Because when Matthew died, Tony Blair was still in opposition. He actually became Prime Minister post Matthew's death. So their relationship was good. Matthew would be invited to the conferences, and that's really where Matthew really where Matthew found out about the helicopter was at the Labour Party conference in Blackpool that happened just prior to that October. I think that's where Tony Blair had gone to the conference via that same helicopter. And that's where the interest came about in using that one.
So their relationship, obviously it's interesting because Tony Blair was a rising star of British politics as well. Outside of that donation, do you remember how it came about that they were, because I think in 92, I think Matthew was connected to the Lib Dems as well, wasn't he?
I believe so. I can't actually say for sure. I think what was happening at the time was Matthew was quite excited by the way in which Labour had a change of policy and appeal. And I think it was a case of Matthew, once again, would have only invested in new Labour. He wouldn't have invested in old Labour. And I think that was the important thing. I was thinking he was quite impressed by the sort of dynamics of Tony Blair and his team. Because if you remember at the time, he had other people with him. The names escape me.
Peter Mandelson, Gordon Brown, Robin Cook.
Yeah. That's it. Well, yeah. Some of the spin doctors, they were called, weren't they, Beck?
Oh, yeah, Alistair Campbell.
I think he was quite impressed by the team. And I think probably there was quite a lot of meat between Matthew and sort of Alistair Campbell at the time. So that's how the relationship all came about. I'm sure the relationship would have developed more. I think Matthew would have been keen to carry on his support for them at the time. I think he saw them becoming a government, you know, in the future. In that respect, I think Matthew sort of, you know, liked to be part of that winning team, like he wanted to be at Chelsea as well.
Moving on to your role with being the executive of the will and dealing with the estate, you say about the challenges you had. Just bring us into that to describe. No, we don't want to find details about what was going where, but just sort of how you were dealing with it and how that related to Chelsea.
So I think Matthew appointed more than one executor, and he appointed executors for specific parts of his life. So as I was a Chelsea fan, he wanted me as his executor to look after the interests, obviously, of the family, first and foremost, and the beneficiaries, but also the interests of Chelsea Football Club. So I had that very much in my mind as to, you know, that I still wanted to, besides carrying out my role as an executor, protect the interests of Chelsea going forward as well. Because I know he wanted me to actually do that. So there was lots of meetings, always with legal representation. I did have meetings with Ken. There was a lot of meeting, and I think the first thing that we had to establish was that we actually had a steady, stable ship, which Chelsea did, you know, so like I think we did. There was still some guarantees in place for loans at Chelsea, which the trust honoured, you know, so that there wasn't any sort of financial strain on Chelsea at that particular point going forward. But the board at Chelsea would have been fully aware that it would have been our intention to liquidate our share interest in Chelsea, because that would be the job of a trustee. But it would be done with the interests of Chelsea at heart. So it was busy. I mean, it was busy because besides looking after the interests of Chelsea, there were the other business interests that Matthew had and many more sort of personal issues that had to be dealt with going forward.
So with that share interest that Matthew had, obviously we discussed Richard Branson at length. Who else did you speak to, and who eventually, what happened with those shares? Did they remain in the trust's name up until Mr. Abramovich came in, or did someone buy them?
Yeah, there was very little interest besides the feelers that we were trying to put out, because as I said, we had to sell them as a whole amount. We couldn't start, you know, splitting them up into little portions that were affordable to people, because that would have devalued that shareholding. So there's not much else to report on interest really going forward. And it did remain as a shareholding within Chelsea until, yes, Abramovich came along and bought the club. You know, so I remember the time. We weren't privy to initial negotiations with Roman. We did hear from one of the solicitors involved in the estates that there was a Russian interest and it was looking promising. And that's all we knew. Then I think you covered Ken sort of selling the club to Roman. And I think the next day, the representatives of Roman made sure that we'd be on board for the sale as well. And it was a case of yes, please. you know, sort of there was no sort of like, oh, can we retain a little bit, or, you know, it was yes, please, let's get this deal done. Because we felt as an estate it was in the best interest, obviously, for the estate, but also we felt it was for the best interests of Chelsea as well going forward at the time.
This is what I find really interesting and something we didn't know until we spoke to you, and I don't think this is publicly being discussed. Had you decided as trustees that you weren't getting value for those shares, you didn't have to sell, right?
No, we didn't. The obligation is to sell. Any trustee or executor will have to sort of liquidate the assets of an estate for the proceeds for the benefit of the beneficiaries. That's very important. And also, as a business, we couldn't take Chelsea forward. You know, that's another important thing. You know, we're not a business. We're not an individual with an income coming in to actually take the club forward itself. So we wanted to liquidate the shares, but we also wanted to do it in a way whereby we got best value for it. And that would be my job as well, to get best value for those shares going forward. And that's what actually happened, which was good for all, I must admit.
Because what I find interesting with it, and this is something Kerry and I have spoken about at length, is that really part of Matthew's legacy is that even close to a decade after his passing, he has influence on the direction Chelsea goes by virtue of those shares existing.
Exactly. Yeah, very much. He did. It would have been a case of, I think the nod that we would sell the shares was a sort of formality in a way. You know, I think it was just making sure that we weren't going to sort of like hold the process up in any shape or form. I think it came at a good time for Chelsea. There was a particular guarantee in place that the state was still honouring. And I think that was becoming increasingly difficult to carry on, as we were an estate rather than an individual or a business, you know. So that had to be sorted out at some point. We realised that it was best sorted out when it was in the best interests of Chelsea and ourselves. And so that's why we did keep that guarantee going until the actual sale to Roman. So,
And that guarantee was the $5 million loan from RBS to Chelsea, and the estate was the guarantee on that. So if Chelsea faltered on payments, the estate was covering that.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. So that was still in place.
So for a layman such as myself, when it comes to things at this level, I can manage my bank account, but not guarantees and loans of this level. Just explain what that would have meant for Chelsea had the estate not been able to put that guarantee up, or if you decided that, look, it's not in our interests anymore, which I think you sort of suggested that it had gone on a bit too long, maybe. Is that without putting words in your mouth?
No. I think we were coming to the point where it was a case of Chelsea had to maybe try and put other plans in place to cover that guarantee going forward from that time. And that was where there was fortune, really, I think, for Chelsea, because that was starting to be discussed. I don't know how difficult that would have been for Chelsea to put in place at the time, but it was at the time where Roman did come along. So it ticked a lot of boxes for everyone.
So if that guarantee had been withdrawn at any point, what would that have meant for Chelsea?
The $5 million would have had to have been paid back. And so Chelsea would have had to have found that £5 million. So that would be the ins and outs.
So Chelsea would have had to refinance that somehow?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not privy as to how easy that would have been one way or another.
Do you think that people know that Matthew Harding still ended up having a say in a strange way in the modern sale of Chelsea to Abramovich?
Yeah, they probably don't. I mean, I think he was still there as a legacy, but I think genuine fans aren't always interested in sort of share ownerships, etc., unless it's to the detriment of the club. And I would suggest that any Chelsea fan now is delighted with what took place. It certainly secured a future. Not that we knew that. I mean, we knew nothing about the man that came in and bought the club. And that's where Chelsea pitch owners did give us comfort at that particular time, let's face it. But looking at the history that we now have since Abramovich bought the club, I think we can say that it was certainly a tremendous day as far as Chelsea was concerned. And I think Matthew would be very pleased about those Abramovich years at Chelsea too. I think I'm sure that Matthew would have loved to have had some kind of involvement with him. Okay. I don't think that would necessarily have worked because I think from what I gather, and I don't know Roman at all, and I didn't meet him. I've got to be clear about that. I think he's someone who operates on his own. So whether if Matthew had been around, that sale may never have happened. I don't know. I really don't know, because it probably would have been dependent on so many other things, what was happening in Matthew's life, etc. at the time. I think he would have liked him. I think he would have liked him because Abramovich obviously showed his knowledge and passion of football as well. It wasn't so much that man of the people where you'd find him in the pub, but he was definitely a man of the people in his behaviour. And I think Matthew would have respected that.
In this episode, we heard details about Richard Branson's interest in Chelsea Football Club. We will be revealing more insight on this in the main series of The Blueprint. However, we have approached Mr. Branson's representatives to seek clarification on this. We asked the following questions. What are Mr. Branson's recollections of Mr. Harding and their relationship? How close was Virgin Atlantic to becoming a partner of Chelsea FC and sponsoring the Stamford Bridge Stadium? Did Mr. Branson ever consider Chelsea FC as an opportunity for promoting the Virgin brand and growing his own profile? Mr. Branson was offered the chance to purchase Mr. Harding's shares in Chelsea FC following his death. He met with members of the Matthew Harding estate and eventually decided not to purchase them. What motivated this decision? How close did he come to purchasing the shares? Did he have any interest in Chelsea FC outside of his relationship with Mr. Harding? Did Mr. Branson ever consider a full takeover of Chelsea FC with Mr. Harding while he was alive? To what extent were Mr. Branson and Mr. Harding involved with business unrelating to Chelsea FC? Mr. Branson provided a video for broadcast at Mr. Harding's memorial service. What are his recollections of this and Mr. Harding's death? Lastly, we asked, if Mr. Branson had taken over at Chelsea, was it his intention to change the Virgin brand colours from red to blue? A spokesperson from Virgin responded on behalf of Mr. Branson, saying, Richard spent time with Matthew, particularly in the lead-up to his ballooning adventures. Matthew achieved a lot in his life and left an incredible legacy. It was a tragedy when Matthew died, and a great loss to his family, friends, and the business and football community. Also in this episode, Mark Killick discussed the helicopter used by Matthew Harding and the circumstances surrounding his leasing of it. The Blueprint approached former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair for his recollections regarding this. Mr. Blair was unavailable for interview, but a spokesperson said, "The helicopter was hired by the Labour Party. This was a rare occurrence which Mr. Blair would not have been consulted on, nor did he make any recommendation regarding it. Mr. Blair was deeply saddened by Matthew Harding's tragic death and said at the time, this is an appalling tragedy and we all feel devastated for his family. He was so full of life and vigour and someone deeply committed to his country." Thank you for listening to the Matthew Harding Tapes. We hope you found the details discussed over these past two episodes to be interesting and informative as we've revealed new details about the rise of Chelsea Football Club. We are releasing the full 8-part narrative series of The Blueprint on the 31st of May, so please subscribe and follow this feed for when episodes start dropping. If you've enjoyed The Blueprint, then please tell a friend and give us a 5-star review wherever it is you're listening. The producers of this podcast would also like to note that any views or opinions represented by guests in this episode belong solely to them and do not represent those of the Blueprint's producers or Highway 61. Any views expressed and not intended to malign any organisation, company or individual. If you've liked what you've heard already, please give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends about The Blueprint. The Blueprint has been written and produced by Gary Hayes and me, Kerry Levy. Our theme music, Blue Day 23, was composed by Mike Canaris with bed arrangements by Jake Bradford Sharp and is used under license from Macasso Music. Vocals are by The Blueprinters, Alison Bender, Chiara Cervazio, Karen Edith Miller, Louis Beneventi, Daniel Childs, and Gary and myself. Leon Radchinsky-Gorman has mixed the series, and Mark Jardine is our designer. Consultant producers for the series are Nick Lapworth, Neil Pacchietto, and Jackie Anklin. We would also like to thank Gary Link from The Missing Link, Taylor Hayes, and everyone who has spoken to us for this series, on and off the record. If you like this series, please share it with your friends and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to another Highway 61 production. For more podcasts like this one, visit www.highway61.media. That's HWY61.media.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Tired of losing weight only to gain it all back? The weight loss experts at SlimRank.com have done the research. SlimRank.com ranks the safest, most effective GLP-1 programs that get and keep the weight off for good. Stop watching the scale go up and down. Go to SlimRank.com and pick America's number one weight loss program today. SlimRank.com. That's SlimRank.com. Your dream body is just a few months away. SlimRank.com.